welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you have an extremely thought-provoking piece up at National Review just in the last few days. It's called Globalization Bleeding. I commend it to all our listeners. And in this piece, you cast a skeptical eye on some of the homilies that we've received about globalization for the last 30 years or so. And there's so many themes that I'd like to take up on this show. Let me start with this one. As I say, 30 years is a good mental benchmark for sort of elite celebration of globalization. This is kind of a post-Cold War development where if I can pick one person as a totem, the Tom Friedmans of the world tell us that we're on the cusp of this new moment in history. All the barriers are being torn down. The world is flat was famously the name of Friedman's book. And you begin this piece by saying that is dead wrong. Globalization is not new. Explain that for us.
Well, Rome, by the beginning of the third century, say 200 AD, there was 70 million people, over a million square miles from Persian Gulf all the way to the North Sea, and from Scotland, the Scottish border, all the way to the Atlas Mountains in Africa. And there was a uniform language, a uniform custom, an elite that navigated, you know, from Spain to Morocco to Greece to Egypt. And wherever they landed, there was the same literature, the same colonnades, the same agora, at least superficially. Not that there weren't all these different races and ethnic tribes, but they at least had been cosmopolitanized, if I can make up a word. And then we had the same thing in the Muslim world with the caliphate. Napoleon tried to do the same thing. Even Hitler did. And for, you know, 2-3 years, Hitler, you could say that the Third Reich existed from the Arctic Circle in Norway all the way down to the Sahara Desert and from halfway in the English Channel all the way to almost to the Caspian Sea. And Napoleon was almost as successful. But the idea behind all of that was, if we can just have one culture and one people, we can energize them all on one agenda. And what people don't realize is that, A, that takes a degree of coercion and dishonesty to suppress nationalism, to suppress tribalism. And the nation state was far more effective in finding areas of commonality between different peoples and then incorporating them within national boundaries and putting them all on the same page and then making, you know, an international system where individual nations got along. And we forgot that with this high-tech culture. And so a guy like Tom Friedman would fly into Shanghai Airport, fly back to JFK and say, it's better than JFK. And then he would get on a high-speed rail into town. He'd say, this is a lot better than the metro. They're superior people. I think he even wrote once, I wish we could be China for a day. And then, i.e., you know, Bill Clinton or Barack Obama by fiat could use eminent domain or government coercion the way the Chinese do and then make, you know, everybody have solar panels or something. But I find it really frightening because it's a synonym for westernization, and we turn over the sophisticated fruits of 100 years of scientific inquiry and progress that was overseen by constitutional government, and then they get it, they being the non-West, and they don't have any regulation, they don't have any audit, they don't have any tradition of the dangers and powers of technology and science. And so then we just think, you know what? Their dog food they send over here looks good. Oh, it poisoned a bunch of dogs. Why would they do that? Or their sheetrock and their, you know, their building materials they send over, it's cheaper than ours. Oh, wow, it dissolves upon, you know, impact. Or, wow, they have 80% of the pharmaceuticals that we need. Our essential medicines are produced in India and China. And some people are saying if they need them before we do in the middle of an outbreak, they're not going to allow U.S. companies to send their product from China to here. Or you have somebody like Michael Bloomberg who spends $500 million to influence a U.S. election. We don't call that collusion, but look what he did. He He gave all these interviews and said that the vice president of China was the most influential man in the world. Ha ha. And then the president of China is not a dictator, an autocrat. And he took his Bloomberg News, this major financial organ, and censored news critical of China. And the worst thing he did was he cooked up this scheme where he's making American financial interests the ability to use Chinese currency, buy Chinese shares in Chinese companies. About a half of them are Chinese communist companies run by the government. So basically, a guy runs for president that has a worldwide news organization that is at the beck and call of the Chinese communist government, and he's trying to get a bunch of investors to bail out and capitalize with bond buying Chinese companies. 45% of them are communist government companies at a time when his own government is engaged in an existential war for survival against this juggernaut. And we don't call that collusion. It's the weirdest thing in the world. But that's what globalization is.
So, Victor, if we locate the origins of this modern fervor for globalization in that sort of post-Cold War, early 90s period, it also helps explain a bit of the deterministic kind of end of history rhetoric around it. This idea that this is sort of the logical last stage of economic development, that we break down all these barriers worldwide, and that's it. Unfettered global commerce forever. We've reached the end point. It's always going to be that way. And you think, as you describe in the piece, that this is an ahistorical way of looking at this.
Yeah, it's never been sustainable. It's been tried before. Socrates, according to Plutarch, you know, much 600 years later, said, "I'm a citizen of the world." And it's always been a utopian fantasy. And all I can say for it is it has no historical precedent that national boundaries disintegrated and a sustainable globalized economy and culture was able to take its place in perpetuity. And I guess you could say that at best, there's people who are naive and stupid that believe in this stuff. And at worst, there's cynical elites who feel, you know, that they're like-minded doppelganger in China or in Japan or in Germany or whatever it is, have the shared taste of themselves, and they all meet at Davos or something, and they don't care about the interior of their own countries. But I think that's what's everybody shocked now. They think, wow, China's got better airports than we do, but why do their kids have no diapers and they have split pants and they defecate when they're little toddlers right on the street? Or why have 400 million Chinese never been to a Western doctor? You know, Tom Friedman didn't tell us that. Or why, under globalization, would an obscure virus in an obscure town that nobody heard of, even though it's probably 11 million people strong, have the ability to reach the United States in 13 hours and go right through security? So the weird thing is that all of our sophisticated people that were champions of this agenda, the Council on Foreign Relations, Harvard Government Department, Atlantic Council, Friends of the UN, all this stuff were wrong. And then this Manhattan crass wheeler dealer developer came on the scene screaming and yelling that globalization was dangerous and that you didn't have a country if the southern border was wide open and you had to audit and check people as they came into the United States, and a country that had to have control over its essential industries like energy and food and drugs. And we all said, wow, he's a xenophobe, he's a racist, he's a protectionist, he's an isolationist. And that again and again, whether it's the caravans that now petered out, or Mexican government who is defending its own southern border or wants to, it redid NAFTA, or whether it's the information that comes out about the re-education camps in China or the Hong Kong protest or the surveillance state, he has a cunning and prescience that our elites didn't have. He was right about all this. And it's really Orwellian to see all these people sort of parrot what Trump has said, and then they never mention the word Trump. And you know, all of a sudden Trump says, I wanted this travel ban earlier, but let's get it done. They got it done on 31st. They said he's a protectionist, he's a xenophobe, he's a racist. And then suddenly Trump hasn't done enough to protect us from people coming in with a virus from China. It's strange. It's really weird.
Let me role play the critique that one could imagine coming from the right on this, or at least the sort of libertarian leaning right. So someone in that camp might stipulate a lot of your points about culture, probably all of your points about international institutions, which they don't tend to like anyway. And depending on the flavor of conservative, maybe a lot of what you say about immigration too. But the place where you'll probably have the hardest time moving is on the economic component, where they'll say, well, look at the fruits of international trade, of international capital flows. Not only have we raised the standard of living for Americans as a result, but look at the people who've been lifted out of poverty in Asia and Africa. And how do we turn our backs on that without making everyone involved poorer and making our economy less efficient? How would you answer that?
Well, and that's exactly the argument I hear every day at the Hoover Institution from my colleagues who are all free market libertarian, Milton Friedman, brilliant people. And they're right in a lot of ways. I mean, we have almost 8 billion people, and people in Mongolia now have eyeglasses, and people in the Peruvian basin have antibiotics. And it has lifted people out. And I'm looking across my living room at my TV and a stereo system. I'm sure they were all built in China and they were affordable, maybe in a way that they wouldn't if they'd been in the United States. But that's a superficial veneer. And when I go to Michigan and I drive through southern Michigan or northern Ohio and I go to look at these towns, I just don't believe they're better now than they were 40 years ago. And I go into my town here. When I grew up in, there were things like a local grape-picking machine. There were Fruithof trailer assemblies. There was manufacturing. There was canneries. When I think out of 250 people, only 6 of us went to a 4-year college. And when I came home on weekend, I remember being 22 at Stanford University getting a PhD program, and all my friends said, you're an idiot. I'm making $9 an hour at Fruithof trailer. I'm making $12 an hour fabricating vineyard wagons. And they were. And they were buying homes, and it was a much more viable. When I go into that same community now, 1/3 of the community doesn't speak English. 40% are not here legally. I go by the federal dialysis center and the state dialysis. There's a line out the door. And I went to the bank today, and once again, somebody in line had to make his mark. I hadn't seen that since I was a little boy. And so what I'm getting at is, and by the way, I live in a Victorian farmhouse that has a wall around it now. And when I grew up here, there were no locks on the doors. So I'm not sure that California has progressed. I'm speaking to someone who just came back this morning from Silicon Valley. It's very impressive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if Americans ask themselves, can a nuclear family have one breadwinner, as most families used to have? Do they have a two-parent family? Is there an opportunity for half the country, if they don't want to go to college, to have a job that will be able to buy a home for them and have some upward mobility? Are they in control of their fuel and food and pharmaceutical futures? Are they sure that if they get in an accident, the person won't just leave the car there and run off and they'll find out he had no insurance, no license, or no registration? I don't think the libertarians can make that argument. Their argument, Troy, is creative destruction is what makes the world go around. And by that, they mean we have no trade barriers, and you have a product, and you let all this stuff in, and it undercuts it, and then the guy goes out of business. He said, well, the Chinese undercut me, and the libertarian says to him, ah, but it's not sustainable because the government subsidized that product, even though it was, and it's really losing money. And the guy says, yeah, but I'm broke. And they said, well, eventually that's not sustainable. And you said, well, when will it not be proven to me that it's sustainable? And then the libertarian says, but it was good for you because there are other people who survived that competition. And even when you went broke, you were lean and mean. You cut costs. You were more productive because you had this foreign competition. And the guy says, yeah, but would you like to make a product at below the market value? And or then the libertarian comes back and says, but millions of people got cheap products. They got a TV they could never afford. And then you say, well, yeah, they're on the dole because they lost good assembly jobs. So it goes on and on. And I guess the answer is we like some globalization, but we don't like globalization when nobody's on the same page. And China's a mercantile international buccaneer. It's an Orwellian police state that put a million people in camps and steals patents and copyrights and dumps product below the market value and manipulates currency. I could go on and on, but that's what they do. And they have no respect for anybody that allows that to happen. They interpret that magnanimity as weakness, and they don't think it should be reciprocated with mutual kindness. And this weird guy named Trump came along and said, I know the heart of these people. I know what they're doing. And everybody said, So the proof of the pudding is in the eating. I'm waiting for the globalists and libertarian economists to say to me that the interior of the United States, outside of, you know, La Jolla or Sunnyvale or Menlo Park or the Upper West Side, is much, much better now thanks to globalization. And I just don't see it. I see technological advances, but as far as social, civic, cultural, gosh, it's a wasteland. At least the Midwest seems that way to me.
So, final question for you then. There is no question a skepticism towards globalization in the Trump administration that is unique amongst post-Cold War presidents. There is just nothing comparable from either of the Bushes or Clinton or Obama. So you've got a crackdown on trade with China, a crackdown on illegal immigration, a skepticism of international institutions that you can see in things like withdrawing from the Paris Agreement on climate change or the Iran nuclear deal. How well do you think the administration has done on combating the excesses of globalization? And maybe more importantly, what remains to be done? Where do you think we are not yet sufficiently aggressive on this? Yeah.
I think concretely they've done very well. By that I mean they pulled out of that crazy Paris Climate Accord, and then they lowered emissions through the transference of energy production to natural gas in a way that we have a smaller carbon footprint reduction than any of the people that are in that crazy agreement. And I think the longer we're out of the Iran deal, the more evident it was how flawed it was. I think when everybody said, you know what, you have to listen to the international community and keep giving $700 million to the Palestinians, we cut them off, and the Arab community basically privately said, what took you so long? And moving the embassy to Jerusalem was supposed to cause another intifada, and telling the Syrians they could get back the Golan Heights was essential to the peace process, and building a wall was going to alienate Mexico forever. Everything they've told us has been completely wrong. But the problem is that this administration has not been able to make that message, or at least dent that progressive wall in the media and government and foundations and the universities. And so the message hasn't gotten out. And where have they not gone farther enough? I don't think it's been by intent. It's just that they don't have the House of Representatives, A, and the Democrats have waged a brilliant coup-like campaign against the president. The guy was inaugurated and 60 people voted for impeachment, and the Electoral College was under pressure not to honor the popular vote of the individual states. And he survived that, and then it was Trump's crazy. We got to get the 25th Amendment. And then Trump hotels are all over the world. He violated the Emoluments Clause. They sued him on that. And then it was on to Mueller and impeachment, and now he's responsible for the pandemic. So I don't know to what degree they were not preemptive enough, but they have not got the message out that their agenda has made a huge difference in everybody's lives. And when I go into this community that's really dead under Obama and under George W. Bush, I see two things. I see a lot of Mexican-American people coming forward. I just got my hair cut today and talked to all the people in the barbershop, and they don't want open borders. They say, you know, were being swamped by people from Oaxaca. They just come here and they get on a health train, and then we don't get care. It's swamped, or our schools have no advanced placement. And one woman said today, you know, Victor, there's a lot of Chinese nationals coming across that border. Got to close it because they got that virus. I thought, wow, that's very strange coming from former open borders advocate. And then you see construction. Everybody, when people visit me, they say, who would want to live in your hell-forsaken town? And then all of a sudden, there's 500 new homes being built as we speak. And it's booming. It's just incredible. And that's the result of deregulation and low interest and tough trade and a message to employers to go out and take risk, and the government's not your enemy, and to don't sick the EPA on you, and et cetera. So he's done wonderfully, but the fact that he's not a shoo-in in the election, or the a fact that people are not more candid about how better off they are, is a testament either to his own crudity and inability to express in a positive way his own achievements, or the sheer hatred and venom and the mastery of transmitting that hatred that the left has developed. Because, you know, if you were, just to finish, if any of us had, even as a private citizen, wrote something to the effect that Gorsuch and Kavanaugh better watch out because they're going to reap the whirlwind, and they're never going to know what's going to hit them, I think the FBI would be at our door. They don't know what's going to hit them in the age of James Hodgkinson and Steve Scalise being shot. But this was the minority leader of the Senate said it. The left just snoozed. So they're very effective. They control a monopoly of information almost.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.